the savings to the community. I mean, just imagine if they find a, because of a basic research in virology, if they find a cure for, not if, but when they find a cure for AIDS, how much was saved. And even though now we're having a resurgence of tuberculosis, again, thinking back of the early period that you were asking me before, the cost of sanitaria, of early deaths, of incapacity in tuberculosis was enormous. And of polio, of any of these things. And if you calculate that, our whole science budget is trivial. Anyway, obviously have a bias, but that's what you want. But I think it's terribly important. And so, so I think the budget has not kept up with the goods, with the amount of science, with the amount of people. Now, in addition, just like in medical care, the equipment to do this has become, more expensive. And there's been an inflation in costs of everything, and so the total has been is causing a problem.
Speaking of equipment, I wanted to ask you about Horaker. Because you've commented that he recognized the advantage of the spectrophotometer very early, and in fact...
This is in my article, was it?
Right.
Yeah.
And evidently he had built... It wasn't clear whether it was an infrared or UV. That
UV. I think what he had, if I recall what the story was... Well, let's go back a little further to show how things developed. When I came to NIH... one half of one of the rooms in the department was a big Bausch and Lomb spectrometer.
Okay.
Great big thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know if you've ever seen one. Maybe, probably not, because...
Seen pictures.
Yeah, anyway, very expensive for its day. Now, the rest... the second part of the story, I'm not sure is true, but probably is true. The story wasn't when Beckman did what he did. He wanted Bausch and Lomb to, to do it, and they refused because they said they had all their money in the spectrophotometer, and that was all they were going to do. Of course, no one ever used it. Anyway, so when the Beckman came out, it was a big thing. There were very few. They were only available to military projects, and I think Bernie Harker in Building 2, it was an industrial hygiene laboratory, and they had one, and he had access to it. Now, I would assume that he had used the spectrophotometer in his work on the yellow enzyme. He must have, in Chicago. And it must have been something that they built there, but I don't know. But what I was referring to is the fact that he gained access to this spectrophotometer that they had in Building 2 and used it very actively, and that was the first that it was used that I know of, extensively, scientifically, at NIH. And this was probably be about 1943, 1944. And then, by the time Kornberg came back from Corrie and Achoa in 1948-49, then the Beckman was rather well was well established. Yeah, but again, it made such a difference. Yeah, that was of course there again. That made such an enormous difference in the whole enzymatic work, because you could do reaction rates quickly and some of the people like Harker and Kornberg and Choa, Corey's, were very imaginative in converting all their enzyme reactions directly or indirectly to be able to use it spectrophotometrically, especially with an AD, a DPN.
So it means just following one wavelength for this
time. That's right, yeah. And but you can do it, you see, then in a few minutes before the enzyme went to pieces, you can do it quickly and so forth. So that was a big development. And also another big development over the years is the fact that these things became commercially available. You asked whether Bernie made his spectrophotometer. I don't know what he did in Chicago, but for example, I know that Hans Stetten put together his, when he was a student, mass spectrometer. But the time it took would be enormous. Sanford Rosenthal, who, as I say, was very imaginative and expert in so many ways, he built a Warburg apparatus, you know, with the shaking back and forth. But all that took time, and you couldn't. Now you buy it, and people get their results, you see. And I think that's made a big difference and increased the cost. So
so you attribute some of the, again, we're getting a little ahead, but some of the growth of the journal to the fact the results are in quicker.
Oh, I think without any question, that's it. I mean, more personnel, of course, is relevant, but also that the results are in quicker, yeah. For that matter, this is way ahead of ourselves, but thinking of, you mentioned the computer. After all, not only you can write the paper faster, but if you want to send it to another journal now with the new programs, you can even change the way the citations are written automatically and send it right off, you know. But this is all, I say it facetiously, but it's all relevant because all of this means that the development is that much faster. I mean, it's just a different order of magnitude.
You made a comment very similar to what Comrade Bloch said when we were talking about some of his very first papers. And I think you had commented on this earlier. When you look back at it now and you see it's on a small size page with wide margins, and Comrade Bloch said the very same thing.
I see,
he looks back on those early papers.
Well, he was on the editorial board way back, I think. I'm sure he was, yeah. Yeah.
You've made the comment that there was no direction given when you came here, and yet you started work with Rosenthal. How did, I'm not sure I remember if you did say it, how that came about.
Well, I think there was a difference. I said for most people, they were able to choose where they wanted to work. In my case, even though I didn't quite realize it at the time, I was really pretty well chosen because I thought this would be a good, where I could really make a kind of, you know, would be a good place for me. But in the reverse, it seemed very reasonable to me too, because between the period of New Haven and with Hastings, that this was an interesting, a very interesting subject, yeah. So, so in that sense, I think, as far as the record goes, sort of, I wasn't actively given the choice. On the other hand, I think if I didn't want to, they probably would have, I could have done something else, okay. But I can't be sure of that, mm-hmm. Yeah.
But at the same time, you said you went off with Kornberg in the evening, we're working on the folic acid.
Well, of course,
that
first place, this was what the atmosphere was such that I could do. I mean, the NIH was that way, but also this is a compliment to Rosenthal that he would. It just never occurred to me, and I think to him, that this would not be perfectly reasonable, you see. And we were using this apparatus on a different thing. It was one of the nice aspects of the institution. And that you could do that, yes.
It sounds like you, this was a real, well, I'm thinking of the old saying, if you're on any campus and you want to find a chemistry building, look for the building that has lights on at night. And this is what you're saying, that this was not a 9-to-5 kind of situation, but the environment was such that people worked without concern for the, or am I reading too much into it?
I think, as at the time, you're dealing here with two different groups, I think, perhaps. I mean, you're dealing with... I can't answer that. I don't know. I would assume that the older group of the people who have been here and whom I'm so complimentary of, I would assume that for the most part they did not work in the evenings. It was not part of the general. I think if you include the newer group that came with the war and after, then you had a completely different situation. Yeah. And as I say, you have said earlier, you got this big influx for so many reasons of the of a group that did work at night and so forth. Yeah.
So there's a greater intensity. How did the older group respond to that? You just said Rosenthal, you gave him credit for his attitude, but in general, how did the older group respond?
Well, I think...
Did any of them come to your journal club, for example?
No, but I don't think it was an active thing. I mean, well, first place, the place was small. And I would say that most of the other people did not have any interest in, in this kind of work. They had their own groups, and we did come through. There was once a month the commission officers had an evening of, I think it was once a month, where papers were given, and a lot of that was under more classical infectious diseases. So, no, it was very much of a very nice academic atmosphere. I don't remember any resentment of this at all. No, it was a very nice... I think part of the story, which goes back to what I was saying about before, and people have expressed it to me, it's not my thought, on why did the grand situation and the expansion after the war mean that the universities and departments across the country changed, and why did they drop, say, prejudices on whom they chose and where they came and took people outside of their own institution. And I think one of the reasons it is mentioned to me is that if you're going to be given grants or given credit for the quality of the work that's done, then you become interested in getting the best people to do the job rather than any other considerations, you see. So I think, and it's a compliment again to the people who ran the NIH, that they were interested in having productive work going on and, respected people like Kornberg and so forth because of the quality of the work. And as I say, Siebel, I gave him every support possible. And so, again, I don't really know these answers, but I think they're to a large extent true. And I think it's true now too. The directors are all under pressure of a different sort now, perhaps. But for when the site visitors come to go over the various laboratories, they're under pressure to. Both real pressure and psychological pressure to show that it's been a productive period, and therefore they're interested in getting the best people. So the only objection, as I say, I heard was from some of the, actually chemists in the building who worried whether we'd get ulcers. So. Parenthetically, just again, something that isn't on the record, but as a chemist, you'd appreciate them. And I'm thinking of a very fine chemist, a nice person, died early. Before your time, but chemists were trained, maybe they still are, but probably not that much, to set up their equipment in beautiful, just right, you see. So you spend a day or two setting up the equipment before you do a the reaction, and then you want to get things, again, before your time, you want to get the clean crystals, you have to have a good analysis. And it was very hard for the chemists, that, in terms of what you're saying, very hard for some of the chemists to realize that you can come in and get your answer in a few hours, get a spectrum without having a crystal, do a distillation without caring whether it was watertight or what have you. So anyway, we did have some of that that I think you can appreciate.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. And of course, nowadays it's even more so. You can, as you know, on nothing, you can take it off a piece of paper and put it in the mass spec, and incredible what can be done. It's been a very exciting period. A very exciting period.
Well, that early period here, let's say through, you had 1, 2, 3, 4, you had 7 papers in a year and a half published.
That seems a little hard.
From 1944 to 1945, papers numbers 3 to 9 on your list.
Well, I think that probably, gee, that's amazing. Well, the reason I say it's amazing is usually I'm quite careful not to do too much publication. I think what that is probably from 44 to 49, you say?
No, 44 and 45.
Well, I'd have to
that's
look
what
at
I was,
that.
See, I've got the list.
Yeah. I think that probably would reflect the fact that I probably did the applied the thinking and analyses of the electrolytes to problems that Rosenthal was doing, and that he was nice enough to 43 of course was Hastings,
right,
and 40 the 44 one was at Yale, the one I was telling you about.
That was this, the first two.
Okay. Then we have one. Okay. The next one was this development of a technique and use of it for hemorrhage in a mouse.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Then the next one was the evening one with Kornberg.
Right.
Okay. Boy, it was amazing. Okay. The next one was also with Rosenthal, and I think to a large extent in that, no, I did a fair amount of that, but I think that was a question of that there were, you know, two of us working together. Lilly was the pathologist, and of course, there again, you can say on some of these things, which is a little different from what I'm doing now, in some of these, this kind of thing, you can formulate a question, like in this case, whether the local trauma affected the total picture. You formulate a question, you can think of really one or two experiments, and you do that, and that's it, you see. The next one, again, was one with Kornberg in the evening, where we were all set up because he had the pyridoxin deficient animals, and we had the hemorrhagic technique. And the next one was my basic work, really, the one on the... the next one was... again, was just a...
Number seven.
Yeah, it was just a measurement of... the next seven was a double... Yeah, two parts. And that was my basic work there. And that really had a lot of detailed work, where I was analyzing the sodium and fluid changes in shock. The next one, again, was with Kornberg. That's amazing there were that many. I think what that amounted to is, again, if you have a technique going, which is not irrelevant, perhaps a little premature, but not irrelevant to what I was saying as a story now, if you have techniques going, you can formulate experiments and... and get results relatively quickly. I'm really quite amazed that it was that we had that many papers. So, in other words, if we had a hemorrhage technique, this was cutting the tail of rats and letting them bleed into a citrated solution, you see. And you could test the effects of various vitamin deficiencies. And if Kornberg had the animals going, you see, and you didn't lose the animals this way, you can, well, some of them you might, but you can measure the blood. It was a very simple experiment.
Mm-hmm.
The next one was a review, but it was really, Rosenthal was nice to put my name on it.
That's number 10.
Number nine. And then by 11, and by 10 looks like pretty much the end of those studies. There was something later, some later that were published late, but from then on I got into more biochemical things.
Mm-hmm.
It was after the war I got into. Rosenthal had started to work in histamine. And
okay, that's how I was going to ask you how you moved into that area.
Yeah.
Then from,
well, of course, histamine is a classic pharmacologic agent, and he was interested in that, and he was interested in it from a pharmacologic point of view, and was developing. Again, he went in the same way that Peters went in, felt that the best thing would be to get a quantitative measurement, and we worked very closely and together, and so I worked with him on that, and then from there I because of that, then I got involved in because of the influence of the Kornberg and Harker in the enzymes, which were so I worked that's when I did the diamine oxidase work.
I was going to ask you at this point how the what the situation was in enzymology and how things had progressed biochemically. We're still talking
1947, 48. Yeah. Well, again, it depends on where you are and what you're talking about, you know, what groups, what era. For the most part, and enzymology in the 30s was based on taking a tissue extract and putting something in, getting something out. The reactions were long, the enzymes would get inactivated, very little was done on, again, in this country, mainly on purification. Of course, there's the exception of obviously catalase, and you know, which was crystallized and so forth. I guess I was 26, but for the most part, for most of these, say if you were studying an amino acid metabolism or a pharmacologic agent, it was done in that. Now, due to the group of Warburg and others, and then Kornberg and this whole group, and plus these very good people like Harlan Wood and so forth, new techniques were developed in the 40s, where at first with the Warburg apparatus, and then especially with the spectrophotometer, you were able to get your reactions done much more quickly. Refrigerated centrifuges came in, and Kornberg, I know, got the first one that I know of at NIH. You kept things cold, you did things quickly, and you purified things. And with a much, again, the Germans had been doing, Warburg and that group had done it, but the concept that you didn't do much work on it until you at least partially purified it, well, was a big development. And here again, there were other groups here working in other areas, as I say, like Holland Wood and so forth, who were doing these things. I don't mean to say that there weren't laboratories that didn't do the clean work, but the big change in the, I think, in the 40s and the early 50s was using, doing all you could to get purified enzymes and to do the reactions under conditions where you did not get an activation, either by denaturation or by proteolytic digestion. And so I think at that point that was a big development. Now, of course, the bigger development is more recently, where you where things are cloned, and so you get much larger quantities, but that's of course much more recent. But at least of the material I know, this was the big development.
Well, and then you, let's see, in paper number 12, the and well, 12, 13, 14.
Well, those were all on the histamine.
On the histamine,
yeah.
Yes.
And parenthetically, just as a background to history, sort of, and a lesson, that if once you never know where projects could lead. For example, I purified diamine oxidase, and that was very nice at the period, and then dropped it. There were certain obscure things about the cofactor, but with the techniques available and with whatever I knew, we didn't do much about it or couldn't. Well, now, this number of years later, which is 40 years later, papers are kind of coming out that there's a very intriguing a kind of cofactor involved that isn't entirely clear yet in diamine oxidase and some other of the amine oxidases that would have been wonderful to have discovered, and especially at that time. But it's really very dramatic because, you know, it's a somewhat esoteric enzyme and yet has a cofactor that's very basic and fundamental. So anyway, then I, from histamine, I got involved in histidine, and that changed again for a very all kinds of using different techniques. For example, the number 16 I did with Hayashi, who is, I don't know if you know him. He's one of the most prominent of the Japanese biochemists, and he worked with Kornberg and was familiar with the use, developed really, the use of adaptive enzymes, bacterial enzymes, using growing Pseudomonas on histidine. And this was a really very important contribution conceptually to all of us, just using bacteria, where you can get much more active enzymes. And in terms of what you were just asking me before, I think this is relevant, that another change in enzymology is to try to choose a system that gives you the best enzymes, and of course using bacteria and induced enzymes, as well as now recombinant DNA, is very important in that.